Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. You're the Cure. Thank you for tuning in and listening today. We've got another exciting show, and this is personally very exciting for me because this goes right to the heart of really all that we're doing at Veritas. And as long-term listeners know, and the reason I named the show You're the Cure is because we do rely on the amazing design of the body to function like it was designed to function if we steward it right. So we're all about the original Latin root word for physician is teacher. So we're all about teaching and supporting people in their road to wellness. So we know that the doctor can't cure you, that all these diseases, including cancer and heart disease, are 95% diet and lifestyle. So genes do play a part, but it's a diet and lifestyle that are so pro-inflammatory, and it's those inflammatory molecules and chemicals in your cells that turn on the bad genes. So we can't just chalk it all up to genetics only. Diet and lifestyle is a huge part of this. And as you know, the four pillars, nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. And as long-term listeners know, the peace pillar is really more the foundation. It's probably three pillars sit on top of the foundation of peace. Your body's not designed to function in a long-term state of fight or flight. I mean, short-term for a few minutes every now and then, very rarely. I mean, that's okay. But day after day after day being in fight or flight mode, you cannot expect optimal functioning of your cells, and therefore it will manifest as symptoms. We call them diseases. So we have to be at peace, and this is beyond just stress management. Y'all have heard me say before, we've got to go deeper into our thoughts based in the truth versus a lie. So obviously this leads us down into the spiritual realm. And is there a God? Is he a loving God? Is it the God of the Bible or some other God? Is there any way to know? Is there proof? Is there this? Is there that? And ultimately, if it does boil down to faith, but there is much evidence to bolster our faith, I believe. And as I've said before, I was born and raised in church my whole life, knew the Bible, knew a lot of verses, knew religion, knew man-made doctrine and traditions of religion even, but also knew evolutionary theory because of my secular education, but even my private Christian education. Went to the largest Baptist school, university in the world, at Baylor, and my freshman biology teacher told me, if you're going to be a scientist, you have to believe in evolution. So a whole lot of evolutionary theory got put into my head over many years, and it brought in doubt and unbelief on the accuracy of the Bible and of Genesis in particular. So I had this underlying doubt and unbelief in me, and it's hard to point people to God's Word, the Bible, for their source of peace and the truth and the answers to how we need to live life if we can't really even believe the Bible, if you're not fully solidified in your belief that this could be true. And it's such a science thing. America, or Western world in particular, seems to be so addicted to science. And then the whole Darwin and evolutionary theory got put up on the pedestal as if that were God, basically, that were the truth. And once I started personally diving into the facts, the evidence, it became so clear that, wow, this is amazing. Everything basically proves the Bible, not the opposite. So if you're a Bible believer and you don't need, like my wife, she just laughed at me. Like, she doesn't need all the scientific proof. Like we're going to talk about today. But some people do, and I sure did. So for those of you who need that or are on shaky ground or who have doubt and unbelief because of the evolutionary education that we've been put under and just our common pop culture, I think this show will encourage you. For those who maybe don't believe at all or believe there's something out there, but they can't possibly believe in religion and God and Bible, as you know, God that talks about in the Bible, because of what, for whatever reason, and you just don't think there is a God or could be, hopefully this show will be enlightening for you too. So we're going to dive right in with our special guest today. We've got Dr. Robert Carter. Dr. Carter is a senior scientist, but also a speaker for Creation Ministries International. And Dr. Carter is a PhD marine biologist, got his PhD in 2003 from the University of Miami. And on a personal note, when I first got introduced to creation science and apologetics and just the scientific proof of the accuracy of the biblical account of creation and Genesis, Dr. Carter actually came to Post, Texas, when I was at the Garza County Health Clinic at my invitation. Creation Ministries International, they will send speakers out if you just invite. Pretty much they'll say yes and they'll come speak, even if it's just to a handful of people in Post, Texas. So I actually got to meet Dr. Carter a number of years ago, and he really helped to bolster my faith and open my eyes to the truth in regards to what does the science really say and does it line up and support Genesis. And so, yes, this is a medical show, but when the peace pillar is such an integral part of our physical and mental well-being, and the peace pillar is rooted in a spiritual belief system, and I'm encouraging people to consider the history book called the Bible as an accurate book, I think it's very beneficial to get some of the science behind that. So, Dr. Carter, thank you so much for coming in today and spending some time with us and our listeners. I think it's going to be very beneficial.
Well, Dr. Ben, I am happy to be here, and I can't wait to see what our conversation is going to go.
All right. Well, we're going to dive right in. First, if you don't mind, is share as much or as little as you'd like with our audience, just to give a little background, kind of where you came from, how you got to where you are today. I think that'll be helpful for everybody to get a feel for where you're coming from.
Well, you already gave a long monologue there on my background as far as CMI goes, but just so everybody knows, I'm a nerd. I'm a scientist. I grew up in the Northeast and came to Georgia for college, and never looked back. I also came to faith in Georgia. I've been a Christian, solidly since I was about 19 or 20. And so I went through the ringer in college as far as creation evolution goes. And then again in graduate school, getting my PhD. But by that point, I wasn't doubting it so much anymore. It was really in my 20s when I was really struggling over this issue. Because it's a big deal. I mean, the age of the earth, how active is God, if there's God at all, how active is he in the world, in the universe? Could the universe have been made by fiat, or do we have to use science and naturalism to explain it? Those are huge questions, and they tore me up for a long time.
Well, how did you come to grips or wrestle with and come to the conclusion that where you stand today? Was it just a slow process, or were there some defining moments?
I can't say that there was a defining moment. I remember I went to Wyuka Road Baptist Church in Atlanta, and there was some creation guys. Dwayne Gish was one of them, and there was a debate at Georgia Tech, and there was a whole bunch of presentations during this weekend, and I was not necessarily on side with the people, but I remember listening to the arguments and then comparing to what I was learning at Georgia Tech in the science department, and I'm like, you know what? The science professors at my college, as smart as they are not addressing any of these questions, and it sure looks like they're wrong. And that was the starting point on a 5-year journey for me changing my mind on the issue. Mm. Yeah. But it wasn't one thing.
Okay. Well, and that was the same with me. It was definitely a journey, but each step of that journey just bolstered my faith more and more and more. And I know you're a PhD, you're a scientist, and there's so much scientific stuff we could get into, from irreducible complexity and missing links on this whole evolutionary theory, carbon dating. But I thought we'd start with kind of, it seems to be looking at all the material on CMI, which I do want to say creation.com is a website for CMI, Creation Ministry International. So many great resources there. But genes and kind of the genetics topics seem to be kind of your wheelhouse. And I get asked this all the time because I'm always preaching, it's diet and lifestyle driving disease. The first recorded myocardial infarction in the United States was one in 1912. There was one in all the medical literature in America. And now there's 600,000 deaths a year. And it's this hockey stick exponential escalation on the curve of all these diseases, really Alzheimer's and obesity and type 2 diabetes and diet and lifestyle, diet and lifestyle, diet and lifestyle. But genes do play a part. As I mentioned in the monologue, but genetic entropy.
Yes.
I kind of want to get your, if you could, explain what that is and how does that help or not help the point of view of a biblical stance on creation?
All right. Well, a little bit of background first so I can shock the audience. My graduate school work was actually in genetic engineering. I started off in the coral reef world, and I started doing physiology experiments, and I ended up in the genetics lab, and I ended up cloning genes out of corals and putting them into fish and making green and red fish with those genes. So if you've ever seen those fish at Walmart or at a pet store, that's not mine. Those are actually my competitors, but that's the field that I was working in. And so when I was done with that, I went and downloaded the human genome onto my computer and started writing computer programs and analyzing that data. And I've been doing genetics ever since. So since about 2004, I have a 1,000 genomes project on Sphere Drive. I'm actually sitting right here next to my computer. All sorts of other genetics things. And I've written papers on the influenza virus and, all sorts of genetic things. And one of my big questions is, can we use genetics and start with Adam and Eve and get to all 7.5 billion people alive today? That's a cool question. I think yes, but that's one of the things we're working on. But genetic entropy is a real simple idea. It's the idea that mutations happen a lot and natural selection is unable to remove most of them. Because for natural selection to work, it has to the difference has to have an effect on the organism's ability to reproduce. And if it doesn't make a difference whether it reproduces or not, selection can't get rid of that change. And most mutations, little letter changes, are almost irrelevant. But if you have like a book, let's say you had a textbook and you had to pass a class, and your grade depended upon how accurate the information in that textbook was. You'll pass the class just fine the first year. But what if you had to make a copy by hand of that textbook and hand it to the next student? And then that student had to make a copy by hand and hand it to the next student. And that student had to make a copy by hand and hand it to the next student. Eventually, nobody will be able to pass that class because of spelling errors and little mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the information slowly gets corrupted over time to the point where it's worthless. That's the idea of genetic entropy. And that applies to all higher organisms, humans, elephants, mice, chimpanzees, anything with a complex genome is doomed to extinction.
Just from simple copy errors that just happen randomly as time goes by.
Yes. So over time, we should be getting worse.
Right.
Not, as Darwin said, better. Now, in evolutionary theory, there's no good or bad, there's no better or worse, but obviously higher organisms like people are a lot more complicated and robust than something like a bacterium.
Right.
But using real math and real science and real genetics applied to that system, the genetic system, you're not going to see vast increases in complexity over time. You'll see decreases in complexity. So yeah, you see change over time. Yes, you do. Things change. That is true. But you don't see the types of change that Darwin needs.
You see
falling apart changes.
Yeah.
You see downhill change. You see breaking change like sickle cell anemia or, you know, hereditary blindness or hemophilia or, you know, I'm picking the big ones, the ones that have a huge effect.
Right.
Most of the changes have a tiny effect and irrelevant until a long time later when the cumulative effects of all the tiny effects add up to certain extinction.
Right. Are there any cases that you've seen, even if it's just on the surface at first looks like, where a genetic mutation brings a higher level of functioning or some increase in information or ability to for an organism to appear to get more complex?
That's a difficult question to answer, because the answer is yes, sort of. I wrote an article on creation.com called 10 Mutations Produce New Information. And my answer is absolutely yes. A different color of a butterfly is new information. a different, if you duplicate a gene, a lot of plants, especially the plants we use in our fields for crops, a lot of those crop plants have doubled or quadrupled genomes. And by doubling or quadrupling the genome, you're also doubling and quadrupling the genes for starch production, for example. So you get a fatter kernel. That wasn't in the wild strain. It's something new. It's a trait that did not exist before. Mm-hmm. But the types of changes we see, the information changes, are not Darwinian. Right. They start with a God-created species, and these things can happen. And look, the thing can modify itself and change over time. Okay, but that's not explaining where it came from. Right. So, yes, mutation can produce new information. Blue eyes would be an example. That's not the original. Blue-eyed people, Adam and Eve probably did not carry the blue-eyed trait. But the light skin of the Europeans, the light skin of Asians, looks like the same gene, but different mutations in the same gene. It looks like a post-creation, in fact, post-flood, in fact, post-Babel mutation that accumulated in a small population as we're migrating away from Babel. So yeah, change can happen, but change is downhill, almost always.
Right. So just right off the bat, I mean, we almost don't have to say anything else because the whole Darwinian theory is so rooted in these mutations, these changes over time create more and more complex things all the way up to the most complex thing, us. And there's just no evidence for that at all as far as increasing complex.
Especially when you consider basic biochemistry, there's nothing basic about it.
Right.
The most common things in biochemistry are the ability to take sugars and make energy. All species do this. They convert sugars into energy. But that process, which you studied in college, is really, really, really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It involves a huge number of genes, a lot of very precise machines operating on a molecule-specific level in the cell to pull off a carbon on this molecule and stick it on that molecule exactly correctly. And if any of those malfunction, you die.
Mm-hmm.
Or you take a photosynthesis, which is a reaction that all life on Earth depends upon. We would not exist were it not for photosynthesis. It would be impossible for animals to be around if we didn't have food. But photosynthesis is an elegant and hyper-complex chemical series of reactions that requires quantum physics and quantum electron tunneling and things like that to work. And it's like these biomolecules are capturing photons. That's like capturing a cannonball. The power of that photon is enough to destroy the biomolecule. And yet it captures it and it hands it off really quickly, as you're playing hot potato. And a little bit of that energy goes into doing some work. And that molecule hands it to another one, hands it to another one, hands it to another one, hands it to another one. Every time that electron is handed down, it does a little bit more work. And all that work together, that energy is used to manufacture sugars. It's the most incredibly improbable series of chemical reactions that anyone could ever imagine. And it is at the very basis for life on Earth.
It's incredible.
So who cares if things change? That's not the question. That's what Darwin thought the question was, but that's not the question.
Right.
The question is, can the changes we see explain where we came from? The answer to that is absolutely no.
Yeah. Well, and just that simple explanation of sugar to energy and light, to photosynthesis to energy, just automatically I'm thinking irreducible complexity, which that's a big word if people haven't heard it.
Yeah.
But the thought that you've got to have multiple components of one organism or one thing at the same time. I give a simple example to our listeners will know this carburetor example I give is the mitochondria is our carburetor. It makes energy. It also makes exhaust. But you have to have fuel, you have to have air, and then you have to have the spark plug, the minerals to create this ATP thing. So just think of your car. I mean, there's the ignition switch, there's a fuel pump, and you got to have the air coming in too. I mean, you've got to have all three of these things together to get combustion. If you take away the ignition switch, but you have the fuel pump and you have the air, or you take away the air, but you have the, you've got to have them all at the same moment, at the same moment in time for them to all function together. You can't pull one out. So the, how does all that evolve together at exactly the same time? That's a real crude example, but it points to kind of even what you were talking about.
That's a great example. And so you have like a, life is a factory, and we're a very high rate processing all these chemicals. So you have to have the chemicals delivered at just the right amount at just the right time. And then as they're getting made, you have to remove them at just the right amount at just the right time. And most of these chemicals are highly toxic, like water. Water is incredibly bad for living things. Water rips apart all the important molecules like DNA and proteins and starches. I mean, water is a disaster to have in the cell, and yet we're based on water for some strange reason. Or oxygen. Oxygen is toxic. Mm-hmm. It destroys everything it touches. And yet plants make it, and we breathe it. We use that oxygen to burn sugars. So, I mean, life is using some really improbable molecules, and that's the way God designed it. It's like we're standing on the edge of a knife. We're so finely balanced and so exquisitely designed that we can do the impossible or the improbable. No biochemist, if they were sitting back, would ever design a system like living things are designed around.
Yeah. Yeah, well, even just the simple design of a car, which I'm not a mechanic, and I probably shouldn't say simple because I sure don't understand the inner workings of an automobile. But compared to us, compared to photosynthesis, compared to the biochemistry inside a cell, but nobody would look at a car or a computer or a cell phone and say that just evolved over time. That just randomly came together. All those parts just came together. I mean, it's so simple. A kindergartner would get that, but somehow we, when it comes to our bodies and creation in general, natural things, we just can't. We've been so programmed, I guess, is the best way to say. With evolutionary thinking. So I want to go back to the genes, because we're just talking in general about whether things could just poof out of nowhere, come and organize versus created. But more from a biblical standpoint in Genesis and age of earth, which I know this can be controversial, and it's not, I guess you could argue if this is foundational to your, you know, is this going to tear apart your whole faith if you believe the earth's a billion years old or 10,000 years old. But from a genetic standpoint and mutation standpoint, and I know you were saying you're working on some projects with mathematics and Adam and Eve from 2 people to 7 billion. Is there anything you can talk about from just age of Earth standpoint and how genetic mutations, and I mean, we have a history book, the Bible, recorded history, even not the Bible. You can say, well, all written recorded history goes back just, you know, a few thousand years, 5 to 10,000 years. Is there something in the genes that you're prepared to say you've been able to mathematically calculate anything?
Oh, yeah, a lot of things. A lot of things. The easiest one was the number of people alive today. That's trivial. I mean, starting with Noah and his family, you only have to double their population every 150 years to get to the number of people alive today. That's crazy. Their populations double a lot faster than once every 150 years. Mm-hmm. That'd be like, you know, at the flood, there's 6 people, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their 3 wives. Then 150 years later, there's 12 people. Now, 150 years later, there'd be about 1,000 or 10,000 people. That's a long time. I mean, you know, between now and 1870, that's a long time ago. Populations grew a lot faster than that slow rate of doubling. So it's easy to get this number of people. What we have to do is we have to kill people off through starvation, disease, war. We have to actually keep the population down. So the number of people alive today is not a challenge. But the genes we carry is also not a challenge. If we get rid of all the rare mutations, things that clearly are new, like, I mean, there's letter changes in me, there's letter changes in you that weren't in your parents. They're just spelling errors. So the machines that copy your DNA, they only make a mistake about every billion letters. They're incredibly accurate. But they have to copy several billion letters of DNA, so they always make a couple of mistakes every generation. If you get rid of all the super rare ones, you're left with about 10 million letters that are found all over the world. So maybe the gene where, you know, everyone in the world is 99.999% identical, but someone has an A and someone has a T. Well, that A and T are found in Africa and Europe and China and the Americas and Australia. That letter variant is found everywhere. That means that letter variant, those two variants, must have been in the original population, because you're not going to get the same mutation in two different populations at random. There's 3 billion letters in the genome. The probability of that single letter turning to a T in two different places in the world is almost zero. Mm-hmm. And when you're thinking that there's like 10 million of these, clearly we came from one population. That means all we have to do is put that 10 million variants into Adam and Eve. And that's not hard to do, because each of us carries about 3 million of them all by ourselves. There's about 3 million places where the genome we got from our mother differs from the genome we got from our father, on average. And those variations don't tend to cause disease. They're common. They're found across the world. They're not disease-causing. I'm going to chalk this up to God-created diversity. And if I carry 3 million myself, it's not that hard to imagine Adam carried 10 million. And if they're not disease-causing, it's no big deal at all for God just to front-load Adam and Eve with some genetic diversity. And then the only thing we have to explain after that are, you know, things I named before, sickle cell anemia, hereditary blindness, and things like that. Those are clearly mutations that occurred after creation as part of the curse and part of the fall.
Right.
So genetic diversity, not a giant challenge. Population size, not a giant challenge. There's some really, really amazing confirmations here. Even the number of Y chromosomes in the world, there's only one Y chromosome. That's the chromosome that makes men men. Women don't carry it, only men do. It gives us a lot more testosterone than women, because there's one particular gene that when it's turned on, it cranks up the testosterone levels. And during development, that causes a baby to develop as a male instead of a female. But there's only one Y chromosome family in the whole world, and man's Y chromosomes from one man to the other across the whole world are not that different. A couple hundred letters different. That's easy to account for that many mutations since Adam, even since Noah. Easy. It's a backright mutation rate that we see in a laboratory. But it didn't have to be that way, because if we came from a common population with chimpanzees, that population would have had a diversity of Y chromosomes. And depending on how it was inherited, it was possible that some men could be more similar to a chimpanzee than to other men. And it didn't work out that way. All men have one Y chromosome family, because we only have one Y chromosome ancestor. We only have one male ancestor. We call him Adam. Well, biblically, we call him Noah. And the same thing is true on the female side. There is a little piece of DNA called the mitochondria. The mitochondria have a little piece of DNA called the mitochondrial chromosome. It's a tiny little thing. It's only 16,000 letters long. But it looks, from a lot of experiments, like you only get it from your mother. Therefore, we have a piece of DNA that we can use to build a family tree of all the ladies in the world. And they all go back to one woman. The evolutionists call her mitochondrial Eve a few thousand years ago. Now, depending on your mutation rate, depending on what mutation rate you want to use, that'll affect your date for mitochondrial Eve. But if we use a mutation rate that we can generate from family trees, Eve only lived a few thousand years ago, not tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago. And so all ladies in the world go back to one woman, like the Bible says. All men in the world go back to one man, like the Bible says. We have enough time to get 7.5 billion people, and all the genetic diversity in the world we're looking at, God could have stuck that into Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
So I don't know why the evolutionary story demands we evolve from a common ancestor with chimpanzees, because multiple parts of biblical accounts fit beautifully with genetics without having to bend and twist things around.
Right. Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. It's not like you have to do some crazy gymnastics make this huge leap that, oh, maybe it could fit. It's like it fits perfectly. It's a hand in a glove. There's not a big leap. The big leap is really on the other side, to think somehow this could all just fall into place. Now, we're almost up against a break, but real quick, because it'll fit with this part of the conversation. I just want to clarify for people who might be thinking, well, what about natural selection? You know, people thinking about the Galapagos Islands and those birds that had sharp beaks versus not sharp beaks, and they could peck the seeds better, or furry dog, you know, dogs that live in the cold have a lot of fur, and dogs that live in the tropics don't have much fur, and vice versa. And so just this natural process of your climate and your environment will automatically filter out certain traits. You know, if you're living on an island and you need a sharp beak and you have a dull beak, you're going to die. So pretty soon all you have left is sharp beak birds on that island. So it's, can you speak just briefly about natural selection?
Okay. Even without life and death, though, natural selection still works in a biblical world. I wrote an article called Natural Selection in Paradise just a couple of months ago. It's on creation.com. And I explained that natural selection, we define it as not life and death. I know Darwin kept doing that, and evolutionists since Darwin have done that, but it's not what it's about. It's about having children. It's some organisms have more children than others in a given environment. You don't have to die. You just have to have 10 kids instead of 9 kids. And eventually your genes will win. Mathematically, if you have just a little bit more kids than someone else, and kids and offspring, shall we say, because look at my plants and bacteria and antelopes. We don't call them children. But as long as an organism has a little bit more offspring than another, their genes will win. And even in a beautiful created world with no sin and no death, you're still going to get some environmental changes because ponds are going to slowly silt up. River deltas are going to grow. There's going to be, a tree will grow in a forest and then it'll get eaten by an elephant. Now there's a bright patch of sunlight on the forest floor that wasn't there before. So the elephant just ate the tree and kept going. So you're going to get environmental changes, and as long as you have environmental changes, you have the probability or the possibility of differential reproduction. Mm-hmm. So Darwin's whole idea of the evolution of natural, you know, how do we say, the origin of species according to natural selection. Fooey, Darwin. Natural selection is part of the Christian worldview without even having to invoke death. So that's one thing we love to do at creation.com, at Creation Ministries, through our website, creation.com, is to take the evolutionary arguments and say, thank you, that's ours, go play with something else.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun when we find those arguments.
Right. And I would encourage everybody to go to creation.com and check out all those articles. I mean, I would challenge you to find any topic from a scientific standpoint, definitely that whole evolution topic. And just type it in the search bar, you know, whether it's dinosaurs or the flood or the missing link, which we'll talk about when we get back from the break. It's a wealth of information, more than you could ever even consume probably. And they have DVDs, they have books, they have just the articles, tons of stuff. They have periodicals that come out, Creation Magazine. I mean, it's an amazing resource. So creation.com is the website. I'm talking with Dr. Robert Carter from Creation Ministries International. So y'all stick with us. I'm Ben Edwards. You're listening to You're the Cure. We will be right back after this break. Okay, we're back. I'm Dr. Edwards. This is You're the Cure. We've got Robert Carter, Dr. Robert Carter, with his PhD with Creation Ministries International. Creation.com is a website. Go check it out. Dr. Carter, thank you again for being with us. This is an exciting topic for me because when I got solidified in my faith, and even though I grew up in the church, when I really got convicted in my heart that this book is amazing, it's true, it's a history book, and it's reliable and it's accurate, and I can completely believe this whole Genesis story, origin story, then it just launched me into being able to dive in deeper into the richness of life that's in God's Word. So personally, it was an awesome time in my life when things got solidified in my heart. So hopefully we can impart that encouragement to for people out there who maybe are in those same shoes. So back to sciencey stuff. I think one of the first things people think of in regards to specifically age of the Earth, the carbon dating and the other radiometric dating. Could you speak a little bit to that? Doesn't that doesn't some of these cardiometric or radiometric dating mean we're billions of years old or millions of years old? So speak to that if you would.
I would love to. However, we have to say right up front, each one of the dating tests is different and requires different answers.
Okay.
We have to analyze each one separately because they're different techniques.
Right.
Most people, when they say, what about carbon dating? What they mean is, what about radiometric dating?
Right.
And so most people don't even know what they're talking about, because radiometric dating, there's like hundreds of different techniques, at least 100. Uranium to lead, potassium to argon, or carbon-14 to nitrogen-14. Carbon dating, though, there's an article on creation.com called Diamonds Are Creationist Best Friend. And it's talking about some work done by the Institute for Creation Research, something called their RAPE project, Radioisotopes and Age of the Earth, where they specifically said, okay, what can we do to do a slam dunk argument? They said, let's see if there's carbon-14 in diamonds. Because the evolutionists claim that diamonds used to be on the surface, that carbon, and it was brought way down deep into the earth and squished and heated to make diamonds and brought back up high enough again so we can go mine them. And so therefore, diamonds are like a billion years old. But they found carbon-14 in the diamonds. By definition, anything with carbon-14 in it cannot be more than 70,000 years old. I don't even think the Earth is that old, but that is a hard limit. You can't have even 100,000 years old and have any carbon-14 left. There's carbon-14 everywhere. We're breathing it. Trees are sucking it up from the atmosphere. There's only a tiny little bit, though. It's like one out of every trillion atoms of carbon dioxide is a carbon-14. So, yeah, we are slightly radioactive. Our bones, our skin, the food we eat is slightly radioactive. And as we're incorporating that radioactive carbon in our bodies, after we die, we stop incorporating it, and it starts to break down. But after 70 or 80,000 years, there'll be zero. Therefore, nothing with carbon-14 in it can be older than that. And yet, every coal that they have samples from the fossil record, from the supposedly 30-million-year-old Miocene coals to the 300-million-year-old Pennsylvanian coals, I'm using evolutionary numbers here, not only do they have carbon-14, they have the same amount of carbon-14. So it looks like they're all around at the same time. And this has an implication in archaeology, too, because carbon-14 is the biggest, most important technique for archaeology and for discrediting the Bible. When the first archaeologist went and excavated Jericho, he found a city that you could actually walk around seven times in the same day. He found a city that had two layers of mud brick walls on top of a front wall that was a rock wall. And it was clear that the mud brick walls had collapsed and made a ramp. And the whole city had been burned and nothing had been taken out of it, except for one place where the wall didn't fall down. This is a biblical story. That was Rahab's house. She lived on the wall, and it didn't fall down. They didn't die. And the Israelites, they went straight up in front of them, each man, because when the walls collapsed, it made a ramp. And they didn't take anything out of the city except for Achan, that troubler of Israel, who got stoned, and his family afterwards. But it's like the whole entire archaeology of the city confirmed the biblical account. And then in the 1950s, famous archaeologist Dame Kathleen Kenyon, she goes and she says effectively, I see no evidence for the destruction of Joshua here. So she took all the evidence and threw it out. Why? Because carbon dating said the destruction layer was a couple hundred years earlier than the Bible says. Therefore, the Bible is completely wrong. But wait a second. No one in the Bible hundreds of years later would have known the details that are written in the Bible, especially the people who believe the Bible is written when they're in Babylon or significantly modified when you're in Babylon, which is after 586 BC. There's no way those people would have known something that happened 1500 BC. Impossible. But the data there, except for the carbon data, but here's the key. The closer to the flood you get, the more the carbon dates are wrong. In fact, they're more the wrong in one direction. Because we know from measurements today that the Earth's magnetic field is decreasing in strength. And the Earth's magnetic field is what prevents cosmic rays to get in from outer space. And cosmic rays are what makes carbon-14 in the atmosphere. That's where this carbon-14 comes from. It literally comes from outer space. But if the Earth's magnetic field is decreasing, then the further back in time you go, the less carbon-14 there should be in any sample. And therefore, the older it appears in a carbon-14 test, because it looks like there's been more time for carbon-14 to break down. But in reality, no, it didn't have as much carbon-14 to start with. So if we use a calibration curve for the Earth's magnetic field, and we look at all these ancient carbon dating things, they fall within the biblical time frame. And Jericho is far enough back that the carbon dating clock is being affected by this point. When you hit the time of Jesus, we know pretty carefully what the date was if we have an artifact. In fact, that's one thing that pegs the Shroud of Turin being not the time of Jesus. It has a carbon date approximately 1300 AD. So, sorry, carbon Shroud of Turin people, the carbon indicates it's not as old as it needs to be. But like I remember went to England a couple years ago, and I went to the tomb of King Richard III, and he was lost. The Shakespeare said they had a bent back, and we know where he was buried, but that monastery had gotten away, and there's a parking lot there and a bunch of buildings. And so they said, we think the monastery was located here in this parking lot. And they started digging the parking lot, and boom, they found Richard III, and he had the worst case of scoliosis that I've ever seen in my life. He did have a bent back, and they carbon dated him, and it was wrong. They said, oh, wait a minute, wait, he was a king. He ate a lot of beef and mutton and things like that. He didn't eat chickpeas like everybody else. He had a different diet, and animals have a different carbon-14 amount than plants do. So they recalibrated it. They rejigged the dates based on his diet, and it pegged him. And I said, okay, this really is him. And that's my point is, you can't just do a carbon date. It's not the way it works. You have to apply a historical model. Another example is this huge debate on where syphilis came from. Did it come from the New World? Or did the Europeans give it to the Native Americans? That's a huge politically correct debate. And so some people found some skeletons in Portugal that clearly died of syphilis, because syphilis eats your bones. It's awful. And when someone dies of syphilis, you can tell just by looking at the skeleton. And they carbon dated those skeletons, and they were before 1492. And eureka, syphilis was in Europe before we discovered the Americas. But then the next scientist came through and says, you can't do that. These people lived on the coast. Most of their diet was fish and shellfish and seaweed. And because it takes time for the atmosphere to mix into the oceans, anything living in the ocean has an older carbon clock than things living outside the ocean. You have to recalibrate the bones, and they dated post-1492. So, in summary, carbon-14 is a great friend of the creationist. And this is one of the things we get to say, thank you, Mr. Evolutionist, go play with something else. Because all carbon in the world looks like it's only thousands of years old in all different forms. And it's not a direct challenge to archaeology, biblical archaeology, if we account for the decay of the Earth's magnetic field over time. It's a cool science. It's a really fascinating science. But as science goes, there's a little bit of art to it that has to be applied.
Right. There are assumptions that are made. I mean, science is the observation, and when we're looking at historical stuff and trying to conjecture back, we have to be careful with all the different assumptions and understanding, like the diet of a king and how to recalibrate things. Before we move on, are there any other radio dating techniques, uranium or anything else that's a real highlight or a quick bullet point on any other methods?
On which subject? On carbon dating?
Well, any radiometric dating like uranium or anything else, any cool tidbits before we move to another topic?
Well, the reason I picked one and I hit it real hard and went for a long time on it was to show that that is not a direct challenge.
Right.
It would take me equally as long to address other ones. Okay. But we can say that when we have historically dated a rock, in other words, Mount St. Helens went off in 1980. We know the rocks in the cone of Mount St. Helens are less than 40-something years old. Mauna Kea in Hawaii, one particular eruption went off in 1952 or 1953, if I remember right. They've dated those also. There's some volcano in New Zealand that's gone off three times since white men have gotten there. They've dated each one of those using a technique called potassium argon. Potassium 40, like in our bones, is radioactive. Yes, we are slightly radioactive. But potassium, when it breaks down into a gas called argon. And so if you look in a rock and you pull out like a zircon crystal, there's argon trapped in there. And the argon trapped in there is based on how much potassium was there. It breaks down over time. Well, hey, let's look at it. And when they measure it, they get a clock rate. But when you apply that to something of known historical age, well, the Mount St. Helens volcano would be several million years old. So clearly that's not right, because we saw it form.
Right.
Clearly, there's argon already in the lava. It's not boiling out like they thought. They felt like because it's a gas, it should boil away. Mm-hmm. And after it cools, anything there is only from the breakdown of radioactive material. So even potassium argon technique is not a huge challenge. Uranium is not used as much because uranium is soluble in water. It can be transported through rocks. It can dissolve. And uranium to lead is really difficult. So it's not one of the real common ones that's used today.
Okay.
They do lead and a couple other weird things, but it's potassium argon is much more common.
Okay. Thank you. That's awesome. And everybody go to creation.com and just type in carbon dating or radiometric, and you can read all you want to read. I want to touch on, we've got about 10 minutes left or so, give or take. I want to try to get to the missing link thing, because you'll see this come up on the news from time to time. Oh, a missing link was found. I think everybody can think back to their elementary school days or junior high days, that picture in your science book of this slow march of a man, an ape, and then he's standing upright a little more, and then a little more, and then it turns into like a Neanderthal, and then it slowly, the silhouette changes more upright and taller, and eventually to Homo sapien. That whole just slow movement. And then there's these missing links. I forget, like Pigman and these different Lucy or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about these missing links? And specifically, I'm thinking of the fraud, because a lot of these were pretty much just made up or based off of one tiny bone chip or a tooth or something like that. Can you speak to that a little bit, the missing links?
Well, that's a very, very fascinating and interesting question. Two friends of mine have written a book. It's called Bones of Contention. No, sorry, that was the old book. It's called Contested Bones, the remake of a 30-year-old book called Contested Bones. It's on creation.com. And they have looked at, in detail, in hundreds, if not a couple thousand scientific papers on this subject, and compiled them all into chapters on Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo naledi, all these, ancient supposed ape men. And what they've discovered is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. First of all, there is no easy chain. That whole progression of time thing from the ape to the modern man, first of all, is based on abject racism. Notice a white man's always on the right side and a black man's behind him. That is an absolutely racist thing coming from European-American racist, eugenicist, Darwinists in the early 20th century. As always, you support the higher race theory of white people. So throw that out. That is awful. Second of all, a lot of intermediates actually could not stand upright physically, and yet they make them almost upright. No. It doesn't work like that. And third, that whole series is gone. There is no easy, simple A plus B plus C plus D equals modern humans. The ape men that we have and where we find them makes the picture so incredibly complicated. there's no one who knows an order anymore. And when we look at these things, there's a demarcation between human and ape. It's there. It's quite clear, actually. But we have to account for the great morphological range of humans. I mean, think of a pygmy, a tribe living in the Central African rainforest. You know, we call them pygmies. They tend to be really short. Or think of a Dutch person. Tallest people in the world today are in the Netherlands. Tallest women in the world, I think, in Estonia. But Europeans are really tall today. In the past, they weren't because of nutrition. So diet, exercise, they affect how we look. And when we look around the world at all the different people, there's a huge range of differences between people that are alive today. Well, the range today is less than in the fossil record. But it's true of most species. You look at rhinoceroses in the fossil record, there are rhinoceroses with four horns, one horn, a horn that comes up and makes a T. Rhinoceroses is hugely different. Horses, lots of differentiation. Camels, tons of differences amongst camels. The species that are alive today are usually a small representation of past diversity. And it's true for humans too. But right after the flood, it looks like there's a lot more diversity within humans than exists today. And a lot of lineages died out. So Neanderthals nearly went extinct, except as they're going extinct, some people who invented farming were moving into Europe and Asia, and they met the Neanderthals. And since they're people, and people do what people do, Neanderthal genes are still with us today. In fact, about 60% of the Neanderthal genome is found in modern people. And there's another group of people called the Denisovans that lived in the East. And about 0.5% of Chinese and Japanese and Korean people is Denisovan. And about 7% of some people living in some of the islands in the Pacific. So factor, we're about 3% Neanderthal, and those people are about 3% Neanderthal, and about 7% of them is Denisovan. So nearly 10% of these people's genome is, quote, non-modern. That is awful to say it that way. So, hey, man, you're 10% ape man. What? No, they're perfectly intelligent. They're perfectly normal people. Because there was no ape man. Neanderthals were brilliant. Neanderthals lived in Europe during the Ice Age. Dude, I couldn't do that. They survived this giant environmental catastrophe. They never achieved a large population size. And the inbreeding was incredible. I mean, when you look at Neanderthal DNA, they're the most inbred people that we've ever seen. No one on Earth today is as inbred as Neanderthals were. So it's really like one little tribe stretched out over a vast area, survived in horrible environmental conditions. And yet, when we look at what stuck to their teeth, we know what they ate. They had a diversity of foods that they ate. Mushrooms and tree bark. In fact, it looks like they were targeting specific trees for their bark. And today we know those trees contain aspirin, willow bark. But only some of the willows, not all the willows. So they were using medicines. They were scouring the landscape looking for rare minerals and taking them back and grinding them up and keeping them in a shell with a hole punched in it so it looks like they could tie a string around their neck and carry the shell around. So they were carrying their cosmetics with them. They had the control of fire. Some people are arguing that they painted in caves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's nothing about Neanderthals to suggest that they were primitive. They were ingenious. Oh, one of the coolest things. Everywhere we find Neanderthal remains, we find little balls of birch bark tar, little black balls of tar. And it took us forever to figure out why. Well, they were making this. If you take birch bark and you peel it from a tree and make a cone and set it in the fire, so in other words, they had fire, at just the right temperature, it won't light up. It'll boil off all the nice smelling stuff, and it'll boil down the oils into the black gooey tar. And while the rest of the world was making spears and taking deer guts and using the string from deer guts to tie their spear points to their spear shafts, Neanderthals were using a super glue made from birch bark. Wow. Now, tell me they're primitive.
Yeah.
They're not. They're not primitive at all. They're brilliant people. Just their lives stunk.
Incredible.
Anyway, and it keeps on going. There's so much about 8 men. It's like we have a whole entire 8 man question and answer section on creation.com for that reason, because there's so much material and so many answers and questions that we get. Yeah. We just catalog them.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just trying to hit so many different things just to get pique people's interest enough to really just to point them back to your creation.com and just dive in deeper, because that's what I did. Last thing I want to try to touch on, I almost hate to even ask in the short time we have left in just a few minutes, but the flood, you know, for people that always thought, well, that was kind of a fairy tale, or is that real? Could you give maybe some highlight, top level views of evidence for a flood and the fossil record in general, you know, Grand Canyon, that whole, just anything, any bullet points there to whet people's appetite to go look up more on the flood, that it actually happened, that there's proof of a flood?
Yeah, it happened. The great explainer of the fossil record and the order of events in the fossil record. But I would have to go deep, and I don't know if I could go deep quickly.
Right.
But right where you are, you're at a transition zone in Texas between the coastal rocks are old, and then you get into Mesozoic right where you are, you know, dinosaurs and stuff like that. And further inland, you get to more younger stuff. Well, this looks like the order of burial. The first thing that happened when the flood erupted is an oceanic event. So things in the oceans died. That's our lowest layer. But see, the things that are buried down there, most of them are still alive today. Clams, brachiopods, starfish, horseshoe crabs, corals, algae. They're all alive today. Now, the trilobites are extinct, sadly. I would love to see one of those. But what it was a pre-flood ocean floor that got buried. And then the land started getting swamped. And dinosaurs lived in the swampier lowland areas. That's the first thing that got buried. That's the rocks around you. That's the stuff starting to get buried. Then later on, the higher elevation started getting overwhelmed. That's where we get our mammals and things like that. So I think we got a pretty good description of the flood and how it fits the fossil record. But you mentioned Grand Canyon. Do you know what a water gap is? When I grew up, driving around the Northeast, we'd go camping in upstate New York or Pennsylvania or something like that. And very often we drove through a thing called the Delaware Water Gap. And I didn't know what that was. All I know is we had to stop and pay a toll. But now I realize it's where the Delaware River flowed through a mountain. And so it was a gap. Well, a water gap is a place where a river flows through a topological high point instead of going around it. The Grand Canyon is a gigantic water gap. When you're standing there, it looks like the land is flat around you, but it's not. It's actually a swell. It's a giant hill, and the canyon is cut in the middle of a hill. Why didn't the Colorado River flow around it? In fact, why did the Colorado River flow to the Gulf of Mexico? That's where it should have gone, but it falls into this giant hole in the ground called Grand Canyon, which is cut in the top of a hill. So from the visitor center, it slopes down in all directions. And when you're standing at the rim of the Grand Canyon, you look north, you see what's called the Grand Staircase. So Bryce Canyon is up there and all these other national monuments. But you can see layer after layer after layer of different colored rocks. That's about a mile thick of rocks that used to cover the Grand Canyon area. So this is weird, because something erased the surface of the earth down about a mile, creating a nearly flat plain with a rise in it, a gentle, very big, rise that goes for 100 miles or so, called the San Rafael Swell. And then on top of that rise, it incised a canyon. And when you look at it from above, on the western side, all the tributary canyons are angling into the river like they should. But on the uphill side, the upstream side, the eastern side, the tributary canyons are actually pointing upstream, because they were flowing downhill when they got incised. This is weird. So there's like three different main ideas within creationism how Grand Canyon formed. Each one, any one of them could be true. One of them is the dam breach hypothesis, that a giant amount of water was impounded in something called Hopi Lake. If you look at the topography of the West, you can put a dam in one place and it'll make a giant lake. Now, the dam fails, all the lake drains out and would drain right toward the Grand Canyon and would carve the Grand Canyon. And some people say, no, it was formed as the floodwaters themselves are draining off the earth. And some people say that, no. As the ground, as all that material got erased, the ground buckled up because it rebounded after a mile's worth of rocks was taken off of it, and it cracked. And then the water got into that crack and eroded the canyon. So I don't necessarily know how it formed, but I do know that it is really enigmatic and strange. And it doesn't look like it formed from slow, gradual erosion. Because that canyon is way too big for the little Colorado River to have carved it.
Right.
And when you look at the material, where'd all the material go? Why isn't it, you know, dumped into the area around Las Vegas or downstream of that? Where's all the material? It's been washed off the continent by something bigger than that tiny little river. Etc. There's so much more.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you could spend a whole college course probably just talking about the flood and the Grand Canyon and fossils. And I mean, we didn't even get to dinosaurs, but I hope everyone's starting to at least get this aha moment of, wow, there's so much here. And evidence-based is a big word we hear in medicine all the time. And there's so many published scientific articles. I mean, these are, I don't want to be rude here, but real scientists. I mean, Dr. Carter's PhD. These are brilliant guys. And it's not just Dr. Carter. He's got a lot of colleagues at Creation Ministries International, and many of them are PhDs. So brilliant guys, have very studied, published, tons of resources. I encourage people to go there to bolster your faith. And if you want to share it with your friends that aren't believers in love, do that. You know, it's easy to get in debates and fight and get us divided. But if someone's earnestly seeking, truly seeking where they came from, who they are, what's their purpose in life, and there's this history book called the Bible, and they need a little more scientific proof of that, creation.com. I highly recommend it. It's my number one source I go to. So, Dr. Carter, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. I learned so much every time I hear you. Just appreciate you spending the
very
hour
well.
With us. Okay, everybody.
The audience was blessed by the conversation.
Well, thank you. I know they were. I sure was. We'll have to have you back someday.
Okay.
All right, everyone, that's Dr. Robert Carter. Check out creation.com as a website for Creation Ministries International. I promise you won't be disappointed if you go to their search bar and just type in any subject you want. We just scratched the surface today, so everybody go there. We'll be back next week with another show. This is Dr. Ben Edwards. You're the Cure.